With a membership of only around 100, it's one of the most exclusive clubs on Earth. In fact, more people have been to outer space than have earned their way into this, the ultimate travel club. According to the United Nations, there are 193 sovereign nations in the world. Welcome to the only podcast that brings you the stories from the dedicated few who've spent their lives on the singular quest of traveling to them all. Welcome to Counting Countries with your host, Rick Gazarian.
Hey now, thank you for joining me on Counting Countries. I'm your host, Rick Gazarian, and today I'm being joined by Dave LeVart from his travel blog, Dave's Travel Corner. Dave and I are sitting in the shadow of his Thai home, a couple of hours east of Bangkok. And during our conversation, you'll be able to hear the sounds of the village, the birds chirping, the neighbor's motorbike, and even a very brief guest appearance from his wife, who is swinging on a hammock under the house during our conversation. Dave and I have known each other for a couple of years through living part-time in Thailand and both being travel bloggers. Dave was on the bleeding edge of travel blogging when Dave's Travel Corner made its debut back in 1996, and he has been sharing his stories ever since, including trekking to Everest Base Camp and then having to be carried off the mountain. He also shares stories of angry men and guns in Lesotho, traveling independently in Papua New Guinea, and visiting Yemen prior to today's civil war. During his 20 years of traveling, he's visited 140 countries. His other passion is wine, and Dave has visited over 850 wineries in the Napa Valley. He plans to visit the remaining 250. Dave also shares a lot of his insights into the travel business as a travel blogger and influencer. And also, I'd like you to take a look at our sponsor, Chasing 193 Volume 2, a book that interviews 20 world-class travelers, including Henrik Jeppesen. He traveled to all 193 countries before he even turned 28. Take a look at the show notes for a link. Thanks for joining me today. Please listen in and enjoy today's episode of Counting Countries. So, Dave, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I love travel. Been traveling 20 years. Started my website, Dave's Travel Corner, 20 years ago, and I also enjoy wine.
That's a nice combination, travel and wine.
It's a lifestyle.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about your life growing up. And what I mean specifically by that, I want to know your travel DNA. Did you come from a family that was traveling every weekend, international trips? What was it like growing up travel-wise?
I wish. No, we did not grow up wealthy, so we were not traveling a lot. We travel every weekend or every other weekend to about 2 hours away to grandparents' house. Travel did not come later. One side of my family does not really travel, and the other side of the family where I got my travel bug from, they do travel.
Where did you grow up? What part of the U.S.?
California, so near Napa Valley, Bay Area, San Francisco, San Jose Bay Area.
And out of curiosity, where did you said your grandmother, where did she live?
Grandparents lived in San Jose back when it was still rural Silicon Valley.
Okay.
So it was agriculture. And that's where my mother grew up. And when we used to visit them, it was quickly becoming Silicon Valley. So this was in the early 80s.
So some potentially very valuable land.
Extremely valuable, considering they live not far from downtown San Jose.
And, okay, so coming from a family that didn't travel a lot, so how did you make that progression? Was there a first trip, a first international trip that you can think of that made an impact on yourself?
Yeah, there was three trips. The first trip outside of the United States was to Canada with my family, to the Rocky Mountains. Impressive from a natural beauty point of view, not necessarily from a dramatically different cultural point of view. Second trip was Costa Rica with a college class. But the third trip is what really turned me on to international travel and culture and religion and food and just the diversity, the differences compared to what I grew up with in California was to Nepal.
Okay, so tell me about Nepal, and how old were you? Were you with the family by yourself at this point?
I was in my early 20s, still in college. It was a college-sponsored trip, and my first time to Thailand was also that trip. This was in 1996, and the goal was to reach Everest Base Camp. And some of us did, and some of us didn't. What, and I was the one who did not.
Okay, so you're in the category that didn't make it. Do you remember offhand how many meters is Everest Base Camp, give or take?
It's 5,000 plus, if I recall. I believe it's in feet. It's around 18.5, I believe, or 18, somewhere in that range. But I found out quickly that I am not good with altitude. And combined with food poisoning was a really bad combination on this trip.
So you got a double whammy of altitude sickness and food sickness while trying to trek to Everest Base Camp?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay, that sounds horrific.
It was. And interestingly enough, that was the trip that turned me on to international travel. So it was a hardship trip. I ended up being carried down the mountain on our guide's back at midnight till about 3 a.m., ended up in a stone hut at a lower elevation, was so weak, was throwing up all night. It was so cold inside this stone hut that the bowl was completely frozen solid by morning. And when morning was reached, I had no energy to physically walk.
So out of curiosity, what's going on through your mind? You're in this stone hut. I'm guessing you're feeling close to death. Are you in fear for your life? Are you delirious?
I wanted to get down the mountain as soon as I can, but it was cold out. It was night. I was just trying to survive and stay warm. And the guide, another lady came with me who was also feeling ill, not nearly as bad as I was. The guide left us at around 3 a.m. and went back up the mountain. And so we were on our own to get down lower because that is one of the that is one way you can combat altitude sickness is by getting to a lower elevation. And the next morning, I was physically unable to walk, so she put me on her back, carried me down maybe 5-10 minutes, dropped me off. I would often throw up, and then she'd go back and get the backpacks and take those down past where I was lying on the ground, drop them down further on the trail, and we repeat this process all day.
So this woman is similar to Superwoman. Like,
yes, and she's shorter than I am.
Yeah. So give me an idea of physical description. Like, do you remember the size of her or the weight of her?
Sure. She was probably around 5'5". Stouter than I am. I'm fairly skinny. But still a Herculean effort to get me down the mountain.
Did she speak any English?
Yes, she was on the college. She was from the college, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in California. So she was on the same trip as I was. And she spoke perfect English.
Wow. So end result was you finally made it down.
Yeah, and it was such a relief. I started crying when I got to the bottom. I just collapsed and I had energy again. It got low enough, drank enough water, And she was exhausted. I mean, she was at her wit's end.
And what happens then? Are you flashing back and playing the whole, trip down the mountain to, recoup your health and mm-hmm. saying, this is the last time I'm ever traveling to a developing nation like this. I'm putting myself at risk. What's the end result of kind of a life-changing trip?
It was the opposite of what you just said. I reflected on that trip almost every day once I got back in the States, just the hardships that I went through physically and mentally. And it's a trip that stuck with me. And over time, I forgot the immediate hardships, and I wanted more of that, just mountains, beauty, culture, religion, all of that, so different than what I was used to growing up in California.
So how did we get there? So when you took that trip, you were in university.
Correct.
You graduated.
Yes.
And how did you transition and make travel your business, your career? Yes. How were you able to do that and figure that out?
It started from that trip. That trip inspired me to start my website, Dave's Travel Corner. And through that website, I've made connections and contacts that have led to work in the travel industry and have led to trips, led to press trips, led to just basically fed an addiction for exploring the world through this website.
And walk me back to 1996, because there weren't any travel blogs, so to speak, of like there are today. I mean,
correct.
1996 is the bleeding edge of the internet. So how did you know to do this, or and what did the travel blog look like 21 years ago?
Yeah, so I had no tech background, but I had friends who do, and they started an internet service provider in 96. So I had the equipment and the resources at my disposal if I wanted to use them as far as creating a website. So I created a website off of our main internet provider, called it Dave's Travel Corner. It was not called, it was not registered as a domain, davestravelcorner.com, until 1999. It was very rudimentary, a few pictures of Nepal, trip description, and just some basic text. It was, I used a program called FrontPage at the time, which was not the program to be using, but it was just basic website.
And walk me down the next couple of iterations or steps that you took from Nepal, getting your travel website up, and what would be kind of one of the next significant trips that you took soon after or next after going to Nepal and almost risking your, well, almost losing your life.
That would be to Europe with my brother, backpacking. So my travel site wasn't making any money. It started out as a hobby, like many, many travel bloggers start out these days. The next big trip was definitely Europe, backpacking. We did it on the cheap, hostels. Western Europe, Eastern Europe seemed like really foreign at the time. And we talked to other backpackers, and if they had been to places like Austria or Czech Republic, we'd go, wow, that's cool. You're hardcore. So it was France and Italy and the UK and Spain and more the west side of Europe. But it was really cool because it was the first basically independent trip that I had taken overseas. My other trips were either with family or with college classes.
So fast forward 20 years now, mm-hmm. and you've become somewhat of a different traveler. So from the guy who, you know, did a school trip to Nepal and Costa Rica, backpacked Western Europe with his brother, which are all awesome and incredible trips, you've now been to 140 UN countries.
Yes.
So how did you complete this transition from the little caterpillar to the beautiful butterfly to go to 140 UN countries?
Time has helped. I got in early on. I made contacts early on in the travel industry. And just the interest in exploring the world and just seeing other countries. I enjoy going back to certain countries, but I really enjoy going to countries I have not yet visited.
And you don't have a specific goal per se to go to all 193 countries, but for all intents and purposes, you've got a good 40, 50 years of travel left in you.
I'm hoping.
I mean, it sounds just through.
Yes. Yeah, just keeping the same pace that I've kept for the last 10 years. Sure. It, of course, as you know, it's more challenging because when you take a trip, instead of visiting five countries all close to each other, there's one country isolated that maybe you've got to go back to and vice versa, likewise.
And you mentioned that, I think like all travelers, you like some countries more than others. You're more fond of some places than others.
Certainly.
So walk me through a couple of the places that are tops on your list that you find yourself going to more than once, or a place that you went to only once but you would love to go back to again.
Well, we're doing this interview from Thailand, and I've been to Thailand many, many times. My wife is from Thailand, and we're at our soon-to-be new home site here in east of Bangkok. So Thailand's definitely on the top of the list. Greece is on the top of the list.
So what do you like about Greece? Why does that one stand out for you?
Initial memories with my brother backpacking in Greece, just riding a motorbike on the islands, the freedom of that type of transportation, the smells, that the fresh oregano, the fresh basil, the food that we enjoyed, the islands, the beaches, the combination of just the ultimate independent place to travel with natural beauty combined with great food.
Have you been able to go back to Greece?
Only in the airport.
Only in the airport, okay.
Only to Athens a few times, just stopovers on the way somewhere else. Yep.
And what would be maybe another place you've only been to once? Great memories, beautiful place you'd love to go back to again?
Not a country, but a continent. And that would be Antarctica.
And what stood out there? I think you went there last year.
I was there last year, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that trip. And what stood out there? What made that special?
I've never seen weather change so dramatically as in Antarctica. I've never seen wildlife that's so unique as in Antarctica. I never enjoyed shades of dark before until I went to Antarctica with the grays, the blacks, just, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just everything's on a different scale in Antarctica. And with my altitude sickness problems, Antarctica is, granted, it's the tallest continent in the world, is my understanding, but most of the mountains are, you start climbing at sea level, so there's not the altitude issue.
And what was your take on the wildlife there? Did that
whales coming up to the boat and breaching and scratching themselves on the side of the boat, and you could smell the breath as they're breathing. The seals, the birds, just wildlife you don't, and the penguins, just wildlife you don't really see outside of Antarctica.
And were you doing any of these brave challenges, like jumping in the water, kayaking? Were you on a tent sleeping overnight?
I was mountain climbing. Okay. I was kayaking. I neglected to participate in the polar plunge. I know my body well. I do not like temperatures that cold. I had a friend who did that. She still has tingling in her toes like a year later.
So that's why we're sitting in 95 degree Fahrenheit
35 weather. Degree Celsius weather in Thailand right now. Okay. Yes, almost.
Maybe we're the smarter ones. So, Dave, a couple of favorites: Antarctica, Greece, obviously Thailand. There's always a darker side to travel. What's one of our least favorite places, countries, cities that we've traveled
probably
to?
Everglades in the middle of July camping, Florida, USA.
Bugs, mosquitoes, snakes.
Terrible mosquitoes, like you're surrounded by clouds of black and they are all biting. And we were camping with towels.
Okay.
So we didn't even have tents. So it was very miserable. And this was after a year of significant work on building a solar car for a solar car race on the East Coast. So this was our post-vacation after the amount of energy and sweat and blood we put into that project. So we were already worn out, and to have to deal with mosquitoes and this incredible humidity in the middle of the swamps in Florida was memorable for the wrong reasons.
Did you cut the holiday short, the camping
we
trip
did,
short?
We did, okay. Absolutely. We spent one night and that was it. We couldn't take it anymore.
Okay.
We ended up in Walmart parking lots.
That sounds a lot more restful than
yes.
A towel covering me in the Everglades. What about underrated place? So somewhere you went to, had maybe some sort of low expectations for, but surprised on the upside. I'll give you my example, as
yes.
You think. So we were just talking about Bulgaria.
Yes.
Not that I had any negative stereotypes for the countries, but I didn't really have any expectations for the country. Spent a good week driving around, renting a car, traveling with a friend, was really, really impressed with the country. I love the old communist monuments. I loved Rila Monastery, which we just spoke about, beautiful UNESCO site, a couple of hours away from the capital. So that's kind of an example that comes
probably
to mind.
Probably, I would
me.
Say, a similar part of the world would be Montenegro.
And what happened there?
Discovered a place called Kotor, which is a UNESCO heritage site, and it also happens to be Europe's southernmost fjord. So on this particular trip, we went there without knowing anything about this area. We got a recommendation at the last minute from a local who told us to go there, and just blown away by the beauty and the history there. There's islands in the water, in the fjord. There's churches on these islands. There's hiking up in the mountains. There's this very historical village perched on the edge of the fjord. It's just a great place just to relax.
Yeah,
and enjoy.
I'm a big fan of the Balkans. Ton left discovery to go there still. There's too much to see and do there.
Absolutely.
What about overrated? So had high expectations and were disappointed.
Lake Como in Italy.
And I think you have some Italian roots, don't you? Italian passport as well.
Correct, a EU passport. Yes. Okay.
So, do you feel guilty saying?
Yes, I do.
Your grandmother would be rolling in her grave.
Como is a beautiful area from a natural point of view. Just the lake and the villages and just the scenery is beautiful. But just we ran into some bad issues, bad traffic, just narrow roads, problems with some people. It was more of the experiences on that particular trip rather than perhaps in general.
And I know you've been to some pretty challenging countries over your travels. What about a scary situation that you felt in danger, at risk? What comes to mind there?
There was on a trip to sub-Saharan southeastern Africa. We were pulled over. Yep.
What country was it?
We were in Lesotho.
Okay.
And looking back on it, it was probably sounds scarier than it was. But we were pulled over by police on the side of the road. I think our expiration on our rental car had expired, which we did not notice when we rented the vehicle.
You would hope they would, the company.
Correct. And they pulled over a large SUV, and a gentleman got out and he started arguing with the police on the side of the road. And then the argument escalated, and he went back to his vehicle, and he came back with a 9mm, some sort of scary weapon. I'm not a weapons expert, but it was a pistol. That probably shows my ignorance right there in weapons. But he pulled it on the police right in front of us.
And but this was your driver? Or
no, this was someone else they had pulled
that
over.
Also pulled
it. They also pulled over for probably a different reason. And so he just pulled it out, aimed it right at the police. And a couple of police jumped him from behind. They had batons. They started hitting him. And we almost immediately, I grabbed my wife and we jumped back in our rental car and we raced off. And that was quite scary. On the same trip, we also came across a riot, which was happening in the road. They were burning things and throwing things. And fortunately, we spotted that far enough in advance. So we were able to turn around. But yeah, just...
So heart's beating fast.
Yes. Get out of there.
Adrenaline's going.
Extract yourself from a situation like that as quickly as you can.
And what was your wife's reaction as well when that pistol was drawn out when you got pulled over?
Honey, what was your reaction? Oh, wait, she's gone. Sorry. She showed no fear. She was... didn't visibly seem to be scared at all.
Okay, so we know which one is the brave one in the family.
Yes.
Dave, we're just talking about the situation. 140 countries. Everybody has a different rule when visiting a country. Some people count sleeping overnight. Some people say I need to do a tourist type activity. Other people say airport. Do you have a rule?
I have a rule at this moment in time. So if I've been to a country in the airport and I've had a meal in the airport or I've been there at least a couple of hours, I do count it with the caveat that yes, I would like to come back and explore this country again. I do count it in my list. I think technically, not technically, but I think to really explore the country, you need a couple of days.
For one of those countries that you went to the airport but didn't leave, which one of those would you like to go to back the most to go take a look at?
Ethiopia or Azerbaijan. I mean, I love the airport in Azerbaijan. Birds chirping, aviaries, little cubicles you can go to sleep in. Really nice airport. I spent all night there. But yes, and Ethiopia, of course, for the just the culture. And
do you have any plans, near future plans, for either one of those countries at this point?
Not immediate plans, no. They were part of other trips where I was visiting countries I had not yet been to. And so they were just stops as part of those trips.
And I shared with you some good news about 30 minutes ago. I said that Belarus just changed their rules on visas for U.S. citizens in other countries, that they're now not required, so that saves you a ton of hassle and around $200.
And I was quite excited to hear that because that's the last European country I have not yet visited.
So looking at that list of countries, your 140 that you've been to, a visa challenge, a visa nightmare, a visa that you felt so gratified when you picked up that passport and saw it in the stamp? Anything come to mind of a tough situation with the visas?
Russia was a little challenging about 10 years ago. Sponsor, proof of funds, address in Moscow. That was worth it. I'm glad I did that. But I haven't really pursued the extremely difficult visas yet. Yemen was fairly easy. That was just on the border, arrival on the border. You would think it would be more difficult, but just crossing the border.
What, we got border from Oman?
Oman, yes, yes.
What year was Yemen?
That was like 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, around that.
So crossing the border from Yemen, from Oman.
At night.
Able to get the visa at the border, which
correct.
Is pretty great.
Yes.
How long did you spend in Yemen? 'Cause
four or five, six days, something like that. My friend had been, and he's the one who told me to go back. He snuck into the country illegally during Ramadan, so he did not have a visa stamp. And he slept in mosques, but he highly recommended we visit Yemen. And I know Yemen's on your plans for this year, is it?
I've actually been before myself, but I was hoping to visit Socotra Island,
yes. Okay.
Which some people are trying to reach by charter airplane these days.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the last two charters that I'm aware of, one in November and one in February, neither one made it to Socotra Island. So I'm actually going to postpone that trip and focus on some countries in Africa instead.
Good.
What was your experience in Yemen? Because I spent a little time in the capital.
Mm-hmm.
I was just so impressed by its magnificence.
Yes.
What was 5 days traveling from Oman to... Did you end up in Sana'a?
No, we did not go that far.
Okay.
We stayed in northeast Yemen, more rural areas. But I needed a lot more than 5 days. I agree completely. Yemen gets a bad rap. The U.S., I think, has the world's number one gun ownership. I think Yemen's number two, which is interesting. But there wasn't any public transportation crossing the border, so we ended up catching a ride with... I think it was a bus, or that wasn't a public transportation. We ended up spending the night with a chief of police who asked us which gun we wanted to sleep with, and he had guns lining his entire room, like not little guns, like big guns, AK-47s and those type of weapons. So he introduced us to another police chief, and we popped to a different town.
So my question is, did you end up sleeping with one of those guns?
We slept with them next to us, not I wasn't holding it when I was sleeping. I didn't feel the need. Yeah, they were stacked up on the wall side around his wall.
And obviously there's so many stereotypes of the Middle East of Arabs. Why don't you dispel that a little bit? Tell me about the hospitality you received in Yemen.
Great point.
And how that might compare to
Cali. Just expanding that a little bit. Hospitality in Yemen and Iran and in Jordan. I was in Iran last year, and I've never been to a country where the people were so curious about me and they wanted to invite me to their homes. And this was authentic. There was no scams going on like I've run into in other countries. This was interested in me, wanting to get to know me, ask me about the United States and share what they do, and people buying me drinks on the streets and people coming up to me and talking to me and asking me who I was and why I was there, and just curiosity. And yeah, combined with hospitality, was quite impressive in Iran. And I found, to a lesser extent, the same in Jordan and the same in Yemen and other Middle Eastern countries as well.
Yeah, especially these days, if you're picking up the newspaper in the U.S. and the threat of radical Islamic terrorism and what Trump is talking about every mm-hmm. single day is kind of the opposite of what you encounter every single
absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. When you're on the ground in the country, you find out it's not like that at all. These are people, they live their daily lives. They're not radicalists.
And Dave, I know you have a tremendous passion for travel.
Yes.
I've known you for a couple years. We've actually even caught up for dinner in Armenia.
Yes, we have.
We see each other in Thailand. We are always talking about travel and trips coming down the pike. But I know you have another tremendous passion and hobby.
Uh-huh.
What's that?
That would be wine and Napa Valley. So I'll just give you a quick outline of what I'm doing there. I started a website called the Napa Wine Project in 2006, 10 years after my travel site. And I've been trying to visit, taste, and write about every single winery in Napa Valley. And I've completed 872 visits and written reviews on my website. So it's given me an extremely unique perspective of a very niche part of the world in a niche industry, which is wine in that.
So that's a pretty impressive number to me. 872 wineries. How many more to go, or how big is that list?
That list changes every day. Napa is a beast that cannot be tamed when it comes to numbers and change in ownership and new wineries and old wineries going out. It's nice to have the international travel perspective that I have, but it's also really nice to have such a narrow niche perspective when it comes to wine in a specific valley in just one part of the world. I have a list of 1,100 wineries. And of that list, there are more virtual wineries than physical wineries. And those are wineries that don't actually own a physical winery, but they buy grapes from vineyards and they make their wine at someone else's winery. And there's wineries set up just to handle those type of clients as well.
What end date in sight? So in other words, do you envision finishing this list in 5 years or
no.
just
it's
in
a lifelong
perpetuity?
Project? Yeah, because things change so dramatically, and I try to keep things updated as well. It's with the travels and the wine, it's intense as far as the time needed for both.
And where's that passion come from? So how did you get so passionate or obsessive about this vineyard project and about wine? What's the background?
Part of its personality, I would venture to say, this obsession with things. A friend and I made wine in high school from second crop grapes. And I had time, I guess, 10 years ago, a little extra time. And I just started visiting wineries. I was researching an article for my travel site on wine, Napa Valley. And one thing led to another. I did not intend to try to visit every winery in Napa Valley when I was writing that article. I got stuck. Sucked in a good way, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a vineyard or two that you like to point to as one of your favorites or best in that region?
Yes, Napa sets the bar high on pricing and limits the number of visitors to many vineyards in the valley. So that can be a challenge for some people visiting the valley on the next properties that I'm going to mention. It has to combine the owner's personality, views, architecture, vineyard history, elevation, pedigree of the vineyards. All of those I look for, and I found a couple of them. One is Continuum Estate, which is run by the Mondavi family, Tim Mondavi and his sister. Another would be Kongsgaard, and his Chardonnay is $175 a bottle, so it's not cheap. And Marston Estate is another really nice property. And these are out of the almost 900 I visited, so these are the creme de la creme.
And not that it's a competition, but out of curiosity, is there anyone else that you're aware of that's been to this many wineries, or are you...
Not in Napa Valley. No. No, because it takes a lot of work at this stage of the project. Almost all the wineries I'm visiting now, other than ones that open new, don't see visitors or don't have permits to see visitors. So I have to reach out. We have to coordinate schedules. I have to convince them that they should let me taste their wines and review their wines. And often these are producers that are producing maybe 500 cases of wine, which is in the wine world is extremely small.
So almost like drawing a parallel to our travel lives.
Yes.
You're now visiting the off the beaten path.
Yes.
Vineyards that are difficult to get. So difficult visa to get or,
exactly.
You know, reclusive owners or dictators that don't want visitors.
Perfect analogy.
Okay,
exactly.
Cool.
And there's plenty of those in Napa Valley, and there's some 4-wheel drive only wineries in Napa Valley, which you might be surprised to hear because it's such a visually a polished place.
And let's talk a little bit more about your travel style.
Yes.
So when you're traveling, what resonates the most with you? Is it nature? Is it the history? Is it, you know, Petra or Taj Mahal? Mm-hmm. Is it the people? What really matters to you,
it's
or what are you after?
Unique experiences and places in a nutshell. So it's something I haven't done yet, whether it's, we were just talking earlier, jet skiing on the Chao Phraya River in downtown central historic part of Bangkok. It's a combination of both urban and rural travels. So I don't like to stay in one area too long. I like to mix it up. So like Thailand's a great example. I love Bangkok, but I only love 3 to 4 to 5 days in Bangkok and then come out to the country.
So you were sharing with me a story the other week, and I think this defines off the beaten path travel, and more so the style which you visited the company. So talk to me about your trip to Papua New Guinea.
Ah, yes. So Papua New Guinea can be in a very expensive place to visit if you go with a one of the high-end groups that go there, especially on the dive trips. We did it independently. We found a gentleman in Australia who'd been there before, and he had recommended some villages to trek to, and he had even listed some contact information of some of the villages. So we reached out to them, and we did the trek pretty much ourselves with the help of the villagers between each village, and got to an area of Papua New Guinea where you just didn't see tourists, and there's not a lot of tourists to begin with. But it was raw travel. There was lots of bugs. It was raining. It was, the rivers were swollen. We had challenges getting across the rivers in some cases. We spent, I think it was a full day or day and a half at the airport, coming back to the airport because the weather was so bad we couldn't fly out. Visited the site of a plane crash that had happened a few years prior. It was just, everything about Papua New Guinea is just really raw and rugged and remote. There's no nationalized road system in the country, so you fly everywhere for the most part once you get outside of Port Moresby. And we were walking around at Port Moresby at night without any hotels, and we had people stopping and just really curious why we were there and telling us they were really afraid of our safety.
Yeah, that's considered one of the most dangerous cities in the world.
Now you say it. Now you tell us.
So, and give me a breakdown of your life and what, or of your travels. I think that might be better.
Okay.
So, what I mean by that, I know you spend X months a year in Thailand. I know you spend X months a year in San Fran, your home. I know you're on the road. So, how are you splitting up your time throughout the year?
Yeah, it's hard. So, Thailand is in the winter, January and parts of February. We are building a house here, so hopefully, we'll be back again sooner than the end of the year. Wine, I do wine tours in Napa Valley, so September and October are the busy months for those tours, so I try not to travel during that time of year. And then I go on a number of press trips and fam trips, and those can happen any time of the year. So it's a balance between the wine, the international travel, and the domestic travel.
And walk me through that, actually, because I've spoken to a number of people on this program. Many of them are not travel bloggers. So at the end of the day, your income is derived from travel. And you just said that, I think, magic word, press trip, where people get all excited about, quote unquote, traveling for free.
Yes.
Which is not the case because there's so much work and effort surrounding on going on a press trip.
Sure.
But break down a little bit the economics of running a blog, how that works, and then tie in working with a tourism board or going on a press trip.
Great
and what that
question.
All means.
Where to start? This is a challenging economic environment for travel bloggers. So I have told you before that I have a list of 8,000 travel blogs in English, .com, .blog, .net, whatever.
That are listed on your website,
on
Dave's Travel Corner.
Correct, yes, under my travel blog directory. So there's, and travel blogging started growing in 2005, 2006, and it's just exploded. So there are a lot of freebies that you can get with travel blogs, whether it's product reviews, whether it's free trips. I'm not necessarily excited about any of that. Often I've been to those places already. I'm more excited about making money from travel because it is a livelihood, and that's the challenging part. So I work with brands and destinations, DMOs, destination, basically like Tourism Australia would be considered a DMO. They're responsible for tourism in Australia. So they pay me to create content and promote it, essentially. So I've built up social media following, and I do photography, I do videos, and I do the written, a lot of writing. So I'm hired in that regard. And oftentimes, what used to be free trips are now paid trips, so you get a per diem.
And that's changed a bit, or it's become, well, what's the way I want to phrase this? So, I mean, there's many, many travel blogger writers who are excited to go on a press trip, period. And I would say the more senior you are or more successful you are, just like any business, the DMOs are going to offer you more, i.e., we're going to fly you to the destination. We're going to take you on this 10-day trip and pay for everything. Plus, we're going to pay you a fee for some certain deliverables that you'll give us after the press trip, like photos, blog articles, video, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct. And that's where I want to be, and that's where I've slowly been going towards. Because there's a lot of, you can get a lot of free trips if you're doing this 20 years like I've been doing, but there's no income from that.
Yeah, it's difficult to pay your electric bill at home with a free trip.
Yes, absolutely. And then there's other ways, selling photography. Last year I worked with the group, they wanted to buy my photos, so I sold them photos. Guest posting is still not going away, so people pay to post a link in an article on your website. And then just if you have a lot of social media, you can do work with Instagram, you can do work with Twitter, and brands will pay you to get exposure on your particular accounts. And I'm talking tens of thousands of followers in many cases, unless it's a niche topic.
Yeah, I mean, and you can give the listener an example. You have like a, I would say, a pretty giant Twitter account. How many followers do you have on Twitter?
Yeah, like 330,000 plus on Twitter. So that's like one of my main outlets. But then Instagram, I really focus on high-quality photography, and so I use that as well. And of course, Facebook and Pinterest and all the rest are in the mix as well. Hmm. And every brand, and brands approach me, so I try to often create a contract, basically just look for the deliverables they would like, and then you go from there.
And at the end of the day, this is a business where you work extremely hard and you have dedicated hundreds and hundreds of hours every single year.
Yes.
To build this business over 20 years.
Yes, it is definitely, that is the case. It's not to the income I want yet, but it's, I mean, it's, yep, that's, you've stated that exactly.
And back to style of travel. If you can, give us an idea. Are you alone? Are you, I heard you say traveling with your wife. Yeah. I heard you going on press trips. How are you, what form of travel are you doing with people?
Everything. Cruises, ocean cruises, river cruises, independent travel, travel with my wife, travel in press groups of 1 to 10 plus. Everything in all of the above. And the press trips are often with small groups, maybe 3 to 10 people.
And Dave, did you ever have a quote-unquote traditional job, a 9-to-5 job where you're wearing a tie?
No.
So you're able to kind of skip that whole...
I skipped that whole thing. Never had a boss. I mean, friends started the internet company, as we mentioned earlier, so I worked there. Very, very long hours. No tie, no traditional hours. Wine is make your own hours, the travel, anything and everything. And that's the challenge. You can have a great month with the travel writing, and then you'll have 2 months where it's just, there's just not much income coming in. So it's a life not for everyone. And I would say, in addition to the travel, one of the key perks for people who want this lifestyle is the freedom.
And I would also, I'd be curious to know sort of opinions or feedback from parents, family, friends. When you started down this path, you graduated college, and I'm guessing a lot of your peers were going to interviews, and you obviously didn't. And the first couple of years, or maybe even longer, what was your family saying? What were your friends saying when they were doing the traditional path?
Yahoo was my first big advertiser, and that was big because that was a 3-year contract. So when I started getting some money coming in, that was good. It's hard when you're just not making any money. And basically, the first 10 years was more of a hobby. And the wine didn't come later. So I was spending long hours working at the internet provider. And so that initially was where the income was coming from. And then the travel came. And then internet faded away. And just focused on this. And family is... Yeah, parents, brothers, sisters, supportive. Everyone's, I mean...
They didn't think you were crazy?
No, they didn't think I was crazy. My brother is a crazy traveler. He travels as much as I do, if not more. And so, yeah, my sister loves to travel. So definitely, my parents didn't travel that much, but the siblings definitely traveled. And so that was, yeah, I was fortunate in that regard. They weren't trying to rein me in.
In living your life, which I think you just used that keyword, freedom.
Uh-huh.
and you get to live a couple months in Thailand when it's cold and rainy back home.
Yes.
You get to go to vineyards in September and October, which is a beautiful time of the year.
Sure.
But is there a flip side? Do you think you missed out on anything from time with family or your best friends growing up and not having a traditional stable life where you're involved in the community or going to, you know, traditional things?
No, I do not. Absolutely. I've been able to see, my sister has two children. We see them fairly often. There's a lot of back and forth, which is different than being an expat overseas in one spot, I would say. So no, I don't feel that. The income from this is definitely a problem. And yes, definitely, I would say being gone from my wife sometimes is hard too. So there's two issues.
How has that changed? And what I mean by that, 2017, You can be in Nigeria and get on FaceTime.
You can definitely
do
that.
And you can see your wife's beautiful smile.
We don't do that, but that would be
something. But I mean, has that made it, I'm just curious from a technology perspective, has life become easier when you're traveling and being able to communicate with your wife and loved ones going back 10
years? The communication is the key difference 20 years removed from when I started traveling. Absolutely. And that's the number one reason why I have the phone, is the communication and the Google Maps. Google Maps is probably the number one app for me on traveling, just
of
getting
course.
Around, finding. I was just,
And let's
revolutionize
take a,
things.
Let's take a sidestep from that.
Uh-huh.
Not necessarily communications, but technology in general. Since you have a 20-year window that you can look back on, from your perspective, how has travel changed with all of these amazing developments in technology? Is it for the good? Does it make it worse? Does it make it easy? Does it take away the surprise?
It takes away the surprise for sure, but it makes it, if I want to go to Ethiopia tomorrow or the next day, I can do so. I don't have to have everything lined up if you're an independent traveler. If you got the funds to buy the ticket, you can get there. You can figure out things right there. I mean, you could do this before, but with the internet, you can do it in the moment, which is quite amazing. And as an independent traveler who does things last minute, I love that.
What were a couple of the most recent last minute trips you took last year?
Last minute was to the Caribbean. I went to Dominica. I did like a 5 countries, no less than that, but territories as well. Trip, totally last minute. So,
how did
doing Airbnb last minute, car rental last minute, just some of the stuff you can take care of on the internet, and just it's even though it's last minute, you plan a trip like 3 or 4 days out, things are already on your initial day when you arrive, things are set for you, and then from there you can wing it.
And what about communicating with the locals? Any facilities for any other foreign languages or English doing it for you?
Spanish, I get by when I'm in Spain or other Hispanic-speaking countries. Thai, very little. Play with Google Translate.
Your second favorite app?
Yes. I suppose so. No, you find English, you get around pretty good with English most places in the world, whether it's hand signals or whether even I've noticed that in Thailand, 20 years coming, even in Bangkok, it was hard to get around with English 20 years ago. Taxi drivers, tuk-tuk drivers did not even speak very much, and now you get around, it's like so much easier.
And looking around today, maybe from a book you've read, maybe someone's blog you've read, maybe someone you've met in person, any travelers that you respect, looking up to, admire, role model, anybody kind of come to mind?
Yes. Those who have been doing this a long time and those who have the perspective, who have actually traveled and been and seen much of the world. And so people like Richard Bangs.
And tell us a little bit about who Richard Bangs is.
He's one of the godfathers of adventure travel, and Mountain Travel Sobek was his company, and he still offers trips to remote destinations and places that it's difficult to get visas, like Saudi Arabia. Very down-to-earth guy, willing to meet, talk travel. I mean, just very open, and also very interested in helping others based on what his experiences and whatever it's been 50 plus years in the travel world, and also a dynamic speaker and a very, very good writer.
Yeah, I've actually read one of his books. The name's escaping me, but it was about him, very young age, going down an Ethiopian river rafting.
Where I think he lost one of his friends.
Yeah, his friends died.
Yep.
No one had ever river rafted this river before, so
yeah, he's done definitely a lot of first descents. And yes.
And also, isn't he a contributor for Dave's Travel Corner as well?
Yeah, I think he's contributed maybe 20 pieces, 15 pieces over the years. And I've met him a few times. I've been to his place down in, he's down in Los Angeles, conveniently located next to LAX.
That's good. Fast getaways. Any other blogs or travel blogs that you read or check out?
Oh, there's so many.
I know you.
I've connected well with someone named Rick Kazarian, so I've listed his website on the front top of my 8,000 travel blogs.
Awesome.
There's a lady I've connected with very well in Los Angeles, Jackie Jung, and she runs BohemianVagabond.com.
What do you like about her travel or travel style?
She's very personable, first of all. She's very willing to help you with her contacts and connections. And she does a lot of volunteer travel and goes overseas quite often, volunteering, collecting resources, income for building schools, things like that. And what I like about Jackie is she's very comfortable in many different worlds, and I look for people like that who are very comfortable in an urban world, a rural world, high society, slums of Mumbai,
society.
India, I mean, stuff like that. People are versatile in where their comfort level lies, and I enjoy that about Jackie.
And being on the road, share with me, if you can, an anecdote of one of those characters you meet on the road. The taxi driver who picks you up at the airport that makes you laugh the whole ride home. The guy at the restaurant you end up sitting next to and then drinking beers till 3 a.m. with. A tour guide.
His name's escaping me, but we met him here. We met him in Chile first, and then we met him here in Thailand a few times. Sai, do you remember his name? The guy from Chile? Sano or something? Motorbike guy. We met him here in Thailand. Anyhow, we met a character in Chile, and we followed up. We met him here in Thailand, and apparently he loves women, and we went to Pattaya with him, and he had some young girls.
Santo,
there you go.
German. Okay.
German, Italian, yes. Character, just a crazy guy. Traveled all over the world. He just telling us a story about the time he was in Pakistan, and he was shot at, and the bullet went right below his butt through the motorbike seat. Stuff like that. Hardcore travelers that you meet that aren't necessarily chasing countries, but they're chasing experiences and freedom.
So you met him in Chile.
Met him in Chile, and stayed in contact.
Caught up with him in Thailand.
Yep, a couple times. Yep, I get emails from him every once in a while. Yeah, you meet some pretty hardcore travelers like that. The stories that they tell are fascinating.
And I can think of a situation kind of that where kind of the informal network that exists, which can be pretty interesting and also beneficial.
Yes.
So I was going to Kurdistan area of Iraq. Last year I reached out to you. You put me in touch with a friend of yours, Lena,
yep,
in England, who had been to Kurdistan, and put me in touch with a professor that she knew. So great to have all these relationships and networks and contacts that you can rely upon to give you information and to create safer trips as well. So pretty cool benefit of having this network.
Yes.
Looking back at your 20 plus years of travel, 140 countries, any advice, a great tip, some advice or thoughts to someone who's not as seasoned as you on the road, besides Google Map?
Don't believe all the media.
Okay. Don't believe all the media, which I think is timely advice
number
for
one,
today.
Just the number one. I mean, don't believe everything you see about a country being dangerous. There's often, if a country's at war, if there's parts of a country that have issues, there's often parts of the country that are safe.
Yeah, I think I look at where I live part of the year when I'm in Chicago. And Chicago's getting, you know, extremely bad press from having an extremely high murder count. So I live in that city, but I don't see it. I don't feel it. It's certain neighborhoods in Chicago, not where I live. And the same can hold true for Iraq, where Kurdistan up in the north is extremely stable and safe. These are Kurds who are allies with the U.S. and supporting us. But maybe the bottom two-thirds of Iraq needs to be looked at a little bit more closely when you go to visit.
Sure. Yeah, do the research. Don't usually I say listen to your gut, but if you're looking at situations, do the research, use your head to look at what's safe and look at the numbers and see what's going on in reality.
Speaking of research, what's that mean to you? So we're a couple of the resources that you go to kind of get an appraisal of the situation of the country that you're visiting.
With my hand on all these travel blogs, I definitely look at travel blogs because there's a lot of independent travelers that will go to these countries that get the bad press. And you can set your Google search based on date and when something was published and double check and make sure that that actually was published close to when they actually went on the trip. And so you can find information that way. So I do look at a bunch of different travel blogs, not one in particular. But there's a few travelers that are going to these places and out of the remote places. And so there's blogs that I research, definitely look on for that. And another tip would be life is more about the experiences rather than the things. Just the memories and doing things and experiencing things, trying things, new things.
So less selfies and more about taking in the...
Although if you're trying to build your Instagram account and you have a good face, every 9 pictures I've heard, you should have a selfie.
I guess why there's no selfies in my Instagram feed. Looking back, Dave, what are you most proud of or excited about to talk about or share when you think of your 20 years of travel?
Building my website. Yeah, building the content, creating a community. I have over 500 writers who contributed for me. I have like 40 writers who contribute regularly, sending people on trips, positively affecting their lives in the travel world, other travel bloggers, other travel writers, helping out people who come to me for help, asking for contacts. I love sharing that type of information and just creating a wealth of knowledge for myself and from others when people are looking to plan trips or get information, advice.
So, and I'd like to kind of emphasize that again, that you have extreme longevity in this business, 20 years. And I don't know if you square the circle that you mentioned. You have 8,000 websites that you track, 8,000 travel websites
travel
on your blog
blog
that you...
Travel blogs. I have 25,000 travel sites in my main directory, but they're all separated into different categories.
So the 8,000 travel blogs, you check those sites twice a year. Talk to me about the statistics behind that.
Yeah, it's a very time intensive process. So I have the program I'm using will check links to see if they're dead or not. It catches a fair amount, but it does not catch all of them. So once a year, we'll go through by hand and we'll check every single website to make sure it's still up.
And what percentage of travel websites, travel bloggers disappear each and every single year?
So every 6 months, I'm removing between 500 to 1,000 based on the last 4 to 5 years of running this list. And the list is growing dramatically.
So up to, you know,
up to
over 12 months.
Yeah, it's quite a high percentage. And so most of these travel blogs are hobbies. They start out often just college graduating like I did, writing about your trip, take a long trip somewhere, and you find out it's just too much work to keep it updated, or you are no longer traveling, or you just, that was it. That was
I think there's a expectation or understanding from some new travel bloggers that life is rainbows and unicorns and you open up a blog and people are going to be sending you checks the next week and sending you to the Maldives and the Seychelles Islands for all-inclusive vacations. And the reality is...
It takes work.
It takes
a ton networking. Of work. Networking is a key part of this building this business. Building up your social media is key. Building content's key. But networking in person is key. Whether it's travel shows, whether it's trade shows, whether it's meetups, whether it's companies like Travel Massive connecting bloggers and PR people and other folks in the travel business. I've had incredible contacts. Just I go to the Travel Massive in Los Angeles as much as I can, and I've had business directly because of meeting people.
And Travel Massive is in essence the LinkedIn, except exclusively for professional travel industry people.
And they have a meetup in cities around the world.
Over 100 chapters around the world.
That's
so
impressive.
Very interesting and great organization. Dave, early, it's the beginning part of 2017. What's on the bucket list for this year? What are some of the highlights going to be for you travel-wise?
Catalina Island.
Catalina Island.
Yes, Catalina. Back to Catalina. We're looking at Tahiti, and I'm looking at Africa, Western Africa. I've been to Western Africa before, but this would be Senegal and Liberia and West Africa.
Okay. So a lot of people, I haven't been to West Africa. A lot of people who have been on Counting Countries tell me that's the most traveling part of the world to go to, Western Africa.
Most what?
Challenging part of the world to visit.
It was I was in the Ivory Coast. I was in Ghana. Ivory Coast was extremely challenging. And Africa is not cheap as people might think. It can be very expensive.
Yep.
With logistics and airfare and getting around, because you want to fly between certain places rather than driving, safety in some cases. I look forward to going back, and they're fairly small countries, but friends have sent nice pictures of beaches, and I think it'll be fine. I'm glad I have the experience of already being there at least once.
And Dave, I'm going to have links in the show notes, but tell people how they can keep in touch with you, get in touch with you.
Yes. So davestravelcorner.com. All my social media is listed at the bottom in the footer. Or you can go to Napa Wine Project to see my crazy other life in the Napa Valley. Yes.
So Dave, I want to thank you very much for joining me today and sharing your travel stories. And want to wish you good luck for the rest of 2017.
Absolutely.
And
maybe we will meet in Africa.
I hope. Okay. So thanks again, Dave.
All right, Rick.
Thanks once again to Dave LaVar from Dave's Travel Corner for sitting down with me today. It was great to learn more about my friend and his 20-year-plus travel career. Check out the show notes to see links to Dave's social media. And also, please consider subscribing to Counting Countries, and even better, if you like the podcast, write a review. I'd love to hear any feedback, so feel free to reach out to me on social media. And remember, check out the book from our sponsor, Chasing 193, Volume 2. It highlights 20 world travelers, including Lawrence Williams, who's been on our program. He's spreading his uncle's ashes in every country in the world. Until then, safe travels and keep on counting countries.
You have been listening to Counting Countries, the only podcast to bring you the stories from the dedicated few who've spent their lives on the singular quest of traveling to every country in the world. Our theme music is Demeter's Dance, written, performed, and provided by Mundi. Get their entire discography at mundiworld.com, MUNDIworld.com. And keep up with Rick and his own personal travel quests at globalgaz.com.